Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from a bi-monthly edition, the July-August edition of True West Magazine. Punch Your Ticket by Peter Corbett. Escape to America's favorite heritage railway towns from coast to coast for adventure and fun for all ages. Amtrak serves 500 American towns and 30 million passengers in a good year. However, it does not provide service to Grand Canyon, Durango, and Silverton, Colorado, or have a train to view starry skies above the Great Basin National Park near Ely, Nevada. To see the true West by rail, it's best to hop aboard one of the many heritage railroads that takes slow rides across some of the nation's most scenic routes. Ride through the giant redwoods in California's Santa Cruz Mountains, or ponder a Wild West murder mystery on a Texas train out of Austin. Dine in luxury on the Chew, Chew, train in Montana. True West has played train master in featuring a dozen of the West's best heritage railroads. These rail entrepreneurs are entertaining their passengers and preserving a vital facet of American history that settled the West. Williams, Arizona. The first train to Grand Canyon arrived at the South Rim in 1901, 18 years before the Big Ditch became a national park. Passenger trains to the park were discontinued in 1968, but Grand Canyon Railway revived service from Williams to the South Rim in 1990. The rail service keeps an estimated 70,000 cars annually out of the national park, reducing traffic congestion and stress for those travelers who opt to ride the train. GC Railway's 65-mile trip across Pinon Juniper terrain takes 2 hours, 15 minutes, and offers views of the San Francisco Peaks, Bill Williams and Kendrick Mountains. Western entertainers stroll through the rail cars during the trip. Passengers have a choice of 6 different cars and levels of service. The train stops at Grand Canyon's 1910 Depot, one of America's oldest log depots. It's a short walk to the South Rim, El Tovar, and Bright Angel Hotels. Passengers have 3 hours to eat lunch and walk along the rim or take a short hike into the canyon before the return trip to Williams. They can also opt for an overnight stay in the park. GC Railway features a steam engine on the first Saturday of each month from March to September and a Polar Express at year's end. Historic lodging. Red Garter Inn with 4 rooms in the 1897 Tetzlaff Building, which housed a bordello and St. Elmo Saloon. Grand Canyon Hotel, established in 1891, one of Arizona's oldest inns. Good Eats, Pine Country Restaurant, serving good breakfasts, lunches, and homemade pies. Red Raven, a casual fine dining restaurant, open from 4 to 9 p.m. Museums, Arizona State Railroad Museum with train cars and outdoor exhibits at the depot and in town. Pete's Route 66 Gas Station Museum, a restored filling station with vintage cars and gas pumps. Art Gallery, the gallery featuring local artists who create everything from jewelry and pottery to kaleidoscopes and Route 66 photography. Day Trips, Barrizona, a drive-through wildlife park with walking paths past traditional zoo enclosures, hiking on Bill Williams Mountain, exploring Route 66. Springdale, Arkansas. The Arkansas-Missouri Railroad has been operating for more than 30 years, carrying freight and passengers. Travelers have a choice of 3 scenic routes riding in restored coaches from the 1920s to 50s. An 8-hour round trip covers 134 miles from Springdale to Van Buren with a 3-hour layover in historic Van Buren. The Van Buren to Winslow route and Springdale to Winslow trip both cover 70 miles in 3 hours traveling through the Boston Mountains, the 1,700-foot Winslow Tunnel, and over 3 trestles. The silver feather premium seating option allows travelers to ride in a dome car with expansive views. The railroad's 1917 Biloxi Blues coach was used in the Neil Simon film of the same name. Historic lodging. The Inn at the Mill, a modern hotel adjacent to the historic Johnson Mill, built in 1835. The Inn at Carnal, a women's dorm when it opened in 1905, and overlooking the University of Arkansas campus. Good Eats, Wright's Barbecue in the nearby town of Johnson. Susan's Family Restaurant, featuring a chicken and waffle breakfast. And the Marketplace Grill, with a menu of sandwiches, burgers, tacos, salads, and steaks. Museums. Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, Ozark Highlands Nature Center, and Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville. Art galleries. Art Ventures and the Ed Cooley Gallery in Rogers, Arkansas. Day trips. Fort Smith National Historic Site and Eureka Springs in the Ozark Mountains, known for its historic district and well-preserved Victorian structures. Felton, California. The Santa Cruz Big Trees and Pacific Railroad has two trip options from Roaring Camp in Felton. A steam locomotive on a narrow gauge track travels through redwood groves up to the top of Bear Mountain. It's a 75-minute round trip. The 1890 steam locomotive was a workhorse engine used to haul redwood trees from Roaring Camp. The other route is the Santa Cruz Beach Train that runs from Roaring Camp to the beach in Santa Cruz. Passengers can board at either end. That trip on a standard gauge track runs through the Henry Cow Redwood State Park and through the San Lorenzo River Gorge. It's a one-hour trip each way. Historic lodging. Fern River Resort, established in 1929, but with added modern cabins and amenities in recent years. Brookdale Lodge in the Santa Cruz Mountains, with its own tattoo parlor, game room, and diner. Good Eats, Cowboy Bar and Grill, serving barbecue, burgers, steaks, and salads. Monty's Log Cabin, touted in an online review as a very charming rustic dive bar. Museums. Big Fort Discovery Museum, San Lorenzo Valley Museum, and 1892 Felton Covered Bridge. Art galleries, Santa Cruz Mountains Art Center, and Scavenge Art. Day trips. Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalks Amusement Park with two National Historic Landmarks, the 1924 Giant Dipper Wooden Roller Coaster and the 1911 Loof Carousel. Henry Cal Redwoods State Park. Durango, Colorado. Anyone who has seen the 1969 Western Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid has seen the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad. It's an exhilarating ride on a 45-mile trip through the San Juan Mountains and Animas Canyon between Durango and Silverton. Maybe it's not as exciting as the two bandits, Butch and Sundance, jumping from car to car atop the train, but the scenery in the San Juan Mountains will certainly take your breath away, especially in Silverton, at an elevation of 9,300 feet. It's a 3.5-hour trip each way, with a 2-hour layover to explore Silverton. There are four classes of service, from open cars to luxury coaches. The DNS uses both steam and diesel locomotives. Travelers can opt for a quicker bus ride on one leg of the trip. Rail enthusiasts can also indulge their inner Casey Jones by signing up for a ride in the locomotive to witness the work of the engineer and fireman. The DNS Narrow Gauge Railroad operates out of its 1882 Durango Depot. Historic lodging. The Victorian era General Palmer Hotel, established in 1898. The 1887 Strader Hotel with 88 rooms. The charming 1892 Rochester Hotel. All are within a short walk from the DS&N Depot. In Silverton, the 1883 Grand Imperial Hotel, restored in 2016. Good Eats. Carver Brewing Company, which has served rail passengers and locals for 40 years. Vittles and Fiddles at the Bar D Chuck Wagon with after-dinner cowboy music. Derailed Poor House with a good happy hour and an eclectic dinner menu. Plus two locations of Sirius Texas Barbecue. Museums. The DNS NGR Railroad Museum, Animas Museum, and Southern Ute Cultural Center. Art galleries, Sorrel Sky Gallery, Scenic Aperture Gallery. Day trips, Mesa Verde National Park, and whitewater rafting on the Animas River. Georgetown, Colorado. The Georgetown Loop Railroad, a narrow gauge track, was completed in 1884 with tourists flocking to the mining town west of Denver. At one time, the railroad operated 7 trains per day. It shut down at the beginning of World War II. The Georgetown train was revived as a scenic railway in 1984 and once again lured travelers to the Rockies. The 75-minute scenic trip travels from Georgetown to Silver Plume on a twisting route that crosses Devil's Gate High Bridge. Passengers can board at the depot in either town. They can also opt for tours at the Lebanon Silver Mine or the Lebanon Extension Mine. The train ride and mine tour take 2.5 hours and are only offered from April to September. The Georgetown Loop operates steam locomotives from late May to early October. Historic lodging. Georgetown Mountain Inn, Silver Lake Lodge and Hotel, Chateau Chaminix, a lodge with a touch of Europe. Good Eats, Cooper's on the Creek, Alpine Restaurant and Bar, and the End of the Line Ice Cream Parlor. Museums, Hotel de Paris, Georgetown Museum, and Hamel House Museum. Art galleries, Georgetown Gallery and Grizzly Creek Gallery. Day trips, panning for gold, or a 25-mile scenic drive to the casino in Central City. Leadville, Colorado. What better way to see two of Colorado's tallest peaks, Mount Massive and Mount Elbert, than aboard the Leadville, Colorado and Southern Railroad? Leadville is the highest incorporated town in North America at 10,152 feet. The LC and SRR route is 1,000 feet above the Arkansas River Valley. That opens up spectacular views of Mount Massive at 14,429 feet and Mount Elbert, 14,439 feet. It's a relaxing 2.5-hour ride through wild terrain in the San Isabel National Forest. Passengers can reserve a table in the heated lounge car where an attendant serves snacks, beer, wine, and other drinks. Historic lodging. The 1886 Delaware Hotel. The 1879 Twin Lakes Inn and Saloon, which previously was a stage stop and brothel. Also the majestic bed and breakfast in an 1880s Victorian home. Good Eats. Quincy Steak and Spirits. Casa Bianca. And High Mountain Pies, which serves its spicy crocodile pizza with a barbecue base, mozzarella, cream cheese, jalapenos, and bacon. Museums. National Mining Hall of Fame, Heritage Museum, and the 1879 Tabor Opera House. Art Gallery. Harper Rose Studios, a collective featuring the work of several dozen artists. Day trips. Twin Lakes and Mount Elbert. Abilene, Kansas. It was a big deal in 1867 when the railroad reached Abilene, which became a boom town for shipping Texas cattle from its stockyards to eastern markets. That lasted only about 4 years, but the former cowtown still has its Abilene and Smoky Valley Railroad. The Heritage Railroad, now in its 30th year, makes regular runs and dinner trains on a 10-mile route to the nearby town of Enterprise. The A&SV operates on track originally laid out by the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific Railroad. Passengers board the A&SV train in the restored 1887 Rock Island Depot. The steam locomotive for this route was built by the Baldwin Locomotive Works in 1919 for the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad. Santa Fe number 3415 hauled passenger trains until 1954 and then was sidelined for decades in Abilene's Eisenhower Park. Historic lodging. Victorian Inn Bed and Breakfast. Ingle House Bed and Breakfast, which is on the National Register of Historic Places. Good Eats. Hitching Post Restaurant and Saloon. Joe Snuffy's Old Fashioned Grill. Museums. Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum, Dickinson County Heritage Center, and Greyhound Hall of Fame. Art Gallery, Jeff Coat Photography Studio Museum. Day Trips, Old Abilene Town and Seeley Mansion. Lewiston, Montana. The Charlie Russell Choo Choo is a dinner train. C-H-E-W-C-H-O-O. Get it? Of course, it honors the legacy of Western artist Charles Marion Russell, 1864 to 1926, whose studio was in Great Falls. The dinner train boards at Kingston Junction, about 15 miles northwest of Lewiston. Passengers travel in 1950s vintage coaches to Denton, following the route of the former Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Paul, and Pacific Railroad. The round trip covers 56 miles in 4.5 hours. The scenery includes the prairies, ranches, and mountains of the Judith Basin. The Choo Choo passes over 3 historic trestles and through a tunnel. Western musicians and saloon girls entertain passengers during the excursion. Dinner is a savory brisket with drinks and dessert. A vegetarian option is available. A North Pole adventure train is offered during the Christmas holiday season. Historic lodging. Yogo Inn, named after the Yogo Sapphire, which is mined in central Montana. The Calvert Hotel, offering historic charm with modern amenities. Montana Bunkhouse, a 2-bedroom cabin that was a former schoolhouse. Good Eats, the Central Feed Grilling Company, a steakhouse in a historic mercantile building serving wine and craft beer. 406 Cafe, serving breakfast and lunch. The Mint Bar and Grill. Museums. C.M. Russell Museum in Great Falls and the Central Montana Historical Museum. Art galleries, Moccasin Mountain Art and Gifts, and the Clint Loomis Studio. Day trips. Fort Benton and its Lewis and Clark Memorial. The Upper Missouri River Breaks National Monument. Ely, Nevada. Nevada Northern Railway has an abundance of options for riding the rails. On the excursion train, travelers ride in coaches or an open-air car on a 90-minute run to the Ruth Mine. They can travel in a vintage locomotive with an engineer, or even take control of the throttle, brakes, and whistle. Groups can pile into the caboose on the Nevada Northern. The Wild West Limited is powered by a century-old steam locomotive and features a cast of cowboys and outlaws involved in the theatrical banditry. A special star train takes passengers out to view the night sky with dark rangers from Great Basin National Park, explaining the constellations. Nevada's Northern Sunset, Stars, and Champagne train rides into the sunset as passengers sip champagne and return under pitch-black starry skies. Be sure to allow enough time to tour the train yard exhibits of the Northern Nevada Railway Museum. It's an open-air museum that includes a series of shops for blacksmiths, carpenters, electricians, machinists, and the engine house where the locomotives are kept. Ely is also home to the Big Four Ranch, which claims to be the oldest bar and brothel in Nevada, dating back to the 1880s. Historic lodging. Hotel Nevada and Gambling Hall, a 6-story downtown building that opened in 1929. Good Eats, Cell Block Restaurant, Nardi's Homestyle Restaurant, and Shooter's Bar and Grill. Museums, Northern Railway Museum and White Pine Public Museum. Art Gallery, Ely Art Bank. Day trips, Ward Charcoal Ovens State Historic Park and the Cherry Creek Mining District. Austin, Texas. The Austin Steam Train Association operates with Southern Pacific 786, a steam locomotive, and a 1960 diesel locomotive, formerly used by the Santa Fe Railway. There's a choice of 9 restored passenger coaches. The trains operate on weekends from 3 depots, Cedar Park, Bertram, and Burnett. The Hill Country Flyer departs from Cedar Park on a 66-mile round trip of 6.5 hours, with a 2-hour layover in Burnett. It travels through Texas Hill Country northwest of Austin and over trestles at the South San Gabriel River and Short Creek Canyon. A Wild West murder mystery train also travels from the Cedar Park Depot at night with a performance by Austin's Hideout Theater. Boxed meals, beer, and wine are available for purchase on the 2.5-hour trip. Historic lodging. The Driscoll Hotel, established in 1886. The 1900 Hotel Ella, formerly a residence. An Austin Motel, a 1938 property with a memorable neon sign. Good Eats, Matt's El Rancho, Country Line on the Hill with its Texas barbecue, and Hoover's Cooking, a soul food joint featuring Southern specialties like pork chops, fried catfish, and crawfish etouffee. Museums, Bullock State History Museum and George Washington Carver Museum. Art galleries, Austin Art Garage, Shelton Smith Collection, and Cloud Tree Studios and Gallery. Day trips, Luckenbach General Store, Lyndon B. Johnson State Park, and National Historic Park. Grapevine, Texas. Passengers on the Grapevine Vintage Railroad have a choice of 3 trips. The 6-hour Cotton Belt route travels to the Fort Worth Stockyards with 2 hours to explore that historic district before returning to Grapevine. The Short Line trip is a 30-minute ride that's ideal for families with young children. The Trinity River trip boards at the historic Stockyards station in Fort Worth for a 45-minute ride that crosses the West Fork of the Trinity River. Grapevine Vintage Railroad passengers ride in Victorian coaches from the 1920s. The trains run on weekends from March to December, with special wine train events in the summer, and a North Pole Express from Thanksgiving to Christmas. Historic lodging, Gaylord Texan Hotel, Great Wolf Lodge and Hotel Drover in the historic Fort Worth Stockyards District. Good Eats, Tolbert's Restaurant and Chili Parlor, Cross Timbers Winery, and Texas Star Dinner Theater. Museums, Grapevine Historical Museum, Nash Farm, and Settlement to City Museums. Art galleries, Great American West Gallery, and Southwest Art Gallery. Day trips, Fort Worth Stockyards, and Amon Carter Museum of American Art, also in Fort Worth. Heber, Utah. The Rio Grande Western Railway was completed in Heber in 1899, and the last train rolled out of Heber's depot in 1968, but local citizens worked to keep the rail line in place. Nowadays, the Heber Valley Railroad offers a choice of scenic excursions. The Deer Creek Express runs year-round on a 90-minute schedule, traveling along Deer Creek Reservoir with views of the Heber Valley and Wasatch Mountains. The Lakeside Limited is a 90-minute round trip to Decker Bay with views of majestic Mount Timpanogos. Heber Valley Railroad also offers special event trains, including Wild West Days, Cinco de Mayo, and a Military Appreciation Day. Historic lodging, Heber Senator Bed and Breakfast, and Homestead Resort. Good Eats, Gucci Goo Barbecue, and Back 40 Ranch House Grill. Museums, Daughters of the Utah Pioneers Museum, Hutchings Museum Institute in Leahy, and the Heritage Ranch Museum. Art galleries, Midway Art Gallery, and Sundance Art Studio. Day trips, Sundance Stables at Sundance Resort, and Bridal Veil Falls and Provo Canyon. Peter Corbett has lived in the West for a half century and spent decades writing about it as an Arizona journalist. On the Road Arizona is his award-winning blog. True West Magazine, July-August 2023 edition. Delivering justice. One determined lawman brought in the big guns. During the rough and woolly days of the 19th century lived a legendary generation of U.S. Marshals whose real-life exploits sound like a dramatic ballad. One young man, Peyton Tolbert, born in 1862, chose to give up his quiet days as a schoolmaster and live the lonely and dangerous life of a frontier peace officer. In reputation and deeds, he would come to embody the agency's motto, justice, integrity, and service. Working out of the U.S. District Court in Fort Smith, Arkansas, Tolbert covered western Arkansas and the incredibly rough Indian territory of what is now Oklahoma. For Tolbert and other deputy U.S. Marshals, the challenge was not just in chasing the bad guys, but in fulfilling the job description that began at the founding of the nation. When President George Washington established his administration and the new U.S. Congress began passing laws, a gap was inadvertently created. The federal government's interests were not represented on a local level. Congress's response was to demonstrate the long arm of the law by establishing the U.S. Marshals Service with the Judiciary Act of 1789. These law enforcement officers were given extensive authority. This was an era when the dispensing of justice was delivered personally, arriving after toting loaded guns, traveling cross-country on horseback to face uncooperative suspects. Posse member Tolbert is remembered for one such arrival in the wilds of Cherokee Nation in 1892. Justice arrived that day in the form of a 16-man posse, a box of dynamite, a portable cannon, which Tolbert had traveled 225 miles round trip to obtain, and a lot of determination. Their mission was to capture notorious outlaw Ned Christie, accused of killing Deputy U.S. Marshal Daniel Maples. Christie had used a steam-powered sawmill to construct a fort in the mountains, with portholes on each side. The hideout, known as the Rabbit Trap, was nearly impregnable, having withstood earlier attempts to apprehend Christie. When even the cannon failed to breach the structure, the posse waited until nightfall. They rigged up a portable barricade from a charred rear wagon axle bearing a box of scrap oak timbers. Some posse members covered small weapons fire for others who pushed the barricade close enough to ignite six sticks of dynamite at the hideout's south wall. From inside, Christie and an outlaw partner fired continuously through second-story gun ports. The dynamite's explosion finally opened the fort, but Christie survived the blast and stayed while fire destroyed much of his fort. Eyewitnesses said when he finally came out, he charged the posse, firing until he was shot down. Tolbert toughed it out for 12 years in the U.S. Marshals Service, risking danger and delivering justice on the frontier. Afterward, he worked for Fort Smith and Western Railroad until his death in 1904. Peyton, Oklahoma, is the nation's only town to be named for a deputy U.S. Marshal. In nearby Clarksville, Arkansas, where Tolbert is buried, residents still remember his family introducing Alberta peach trees to the area. The fruit of descendant trees has brought renown to the area ever since. Long before the Tolbert family immigrated to the New World to plant trees, they lived in Shropshire, England. The motto, "Ready to Accomplish," on the family's coat of arms proved prophetic for their ancestor, the determined lawman, Peyton Tolbert. Tom Argerton is an Arizona-based freelance writer. True West Magazine, July-August 2023 edition. The Law Comes to Oklahoma by Johnny D. Boggs. Follow the path of law and order from Fort Smith to Guthrie via Tahlequah and Muskogee. The law came to Indian Territory, which would become Oklahoma, but it came at first through Fort Smith, Arkansas. On May 10, 1875, Isaac Parker sat on the bench for his first appearance as judge of the Western District of Arkansas. That included 18 Arkansas counties and all of Indian Territory, 74,000 square miles that a Kansas newspaper in 1874 called the ever-ready criminal's paradise, which a small group of deputy U.S. marshals had to police. As the saying went, there is no Sunday west of St. Louis, no God west of Fort Smith. At least that's what many think. After all, Charles Portis's True Grit and other novels, films, and TV series couldn't be wrong. But there was law in the Indian Territory long before Parker's reign. The five civilized tribes, Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole, were recognized by the U.S. government as self-governing nations with their own allotted lands, and each tribe had its laws, courts, and police force. Art T. Burton writes in Black, Red, and Deadly, Black and Indian Gunfighters of the Indian Territory, 1870 to 1907. The Native Americans' police were called Light Horse because they were a mounted police force. But then, and today, Indian jurisdiction was limited. Indian courts had no jurisdiction over white invaders, Burton notes. Moreover, they lost jurisdiction over every Indian who committed any crime against or in company with a white. A lawman named Six Killer. In the Cherokee capital of Tahlequah, a national prison was completed in 1875. The first high sheriff of the two-story sandstone institution, the only penitentiary in Indian Territory until 1901, was Sam Six Killer. The statistics show that there's much less crime in the Indian Territory than is generally supposed, the Boston Evening Transcript reported in 1881. There are only 28 persons in the Cherokee Penitentiary, and a large number of the reported cases of violence come from the presences, lawlessly, of white men in the territory. Six Killer left the job in 1880, became the Union Agency's captain of Indian police, and was hired as a federal deputy for Parker's court. Six Killer, whose duties more nearly corresponded to a Wyatt Earp or a Wild Bill Hickok, historian William T. Hagen observed, was murdered in 1886 in Muskogee. Deputy Marshals. The February 21st, 1876 issue of the St. Louis Globe-Democrat reported these numbers from the 1875 terms of Fort Smith's U.S. District Court. 86 men were hanged at the Fort Smith gallows from 1873 to 96, and 79 of them per Parker's sentence, though he sentenced 160 to death. Parker tried 13,490 cases and sent many to the Detroit House of Corrections, reportedly because it had a good trade school. But the Globe-Democrat also reported out the price federal deputies sometimes paid for trying to bring criminals to justice. 23 deputies, guards, and posse members killed, and 27 wounded while in charge of prisoners or in endeavoring to arrest men for whom they had writs. And that was just by early 1876. Frank Dalton, brother of those Daltons who turned to bank and train robbery, pinned on a deputy marshal's badge in Fort Smith in 1884. On November 27, 1887, Dalton and Deputy J.R. Cole tried to arrest Dave Smith in the Cherokee Nation. Dalton was wounded, then brutally murdered, leading the Fayetteville, Arkansas Democrat to state, "It is becoming too hot for deputy marshals in the Indian Territory." More than 120 deputies were killed in what is now Oklahoma between 1872 and 1971. Law comes to Guthrie. Parker's jurisdiction got smaller with the Courts Act of 1883, which reduced Parker's territorial authority to the five civilized tribes and split the rest of the territory into courts in Kansas and Texas. Congress would continue to tweak with the federal courts until Oklahoma statehood came in 1907. In 1889, the town of Guthrie sprang up when the unassigned lands in Indian Territory were open to non-Indian settlers. With the creation of the territory of Oklahoma a year later, 32-year-old E.D. Nix was appointed U.S. Marshal, the youngest U.S. Marshal in history. Guthrie became Oklahoma's territorial capital in 1890 and state capital from 1907 to 1910. Without laws like Bill Doolin and the Daltons running around in the 1890s, Nix hired deputies including Heck Thomas, Bill Tilghman, and Chris Madison. That trio would become known as the Three Guardsmen for their exploits, although historian Nancy B. Samuelson has written that those deputies and their boss were involved in questionable and illegal activities themselves. Yes, in 1896, Tilghman arrested Bill Doolin in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and returned him to Guthrie. After Doolin escaped from the Guthrie jail, Thomas led the posse that killed the outlaw, and Madison, who died in 1944 at age 92, had a long career in law enforcement. But Samuelson argues that Madison hoodwinked a number of historians with his tall tales and spent most of his career behind a desk, that while Thomas's record as a deputy U.S. Marshal under Fort Smith Court is probably without equal, he was probably a bigamist, that Tilghman did as much to break the law during his life as he did to enforce it, and that Nix turned out to be a very good press agent for himself. Bass Reeves. But one lawman's record remains untarnished. Born into slavery in Arkansas, Bass Reeves was commissioned a federal deputy in 1875 and worked out of Fort Smith and then Paris, Texas. In 1898, after a year in Wetumpka Indian Territory, Reeves was transferred to Muskogee. Over a career of more than three decades, Reeves reportedly arrested more than 3,000 people and killed 14 outlaws. He even arrested his own son, who was convicted of murdering his wife. When the federal marshal suggested that another deputy make the arrest, Reeves responded, "Give me the writ." After his death in 1910, the Muskogee Daily Phoenix eulogized the lawman. In the history of the early days of eastern Oklahoma, the name of Bass Reeves has a place in the front rank among those who cleaned out the old Indian territory of outlaws and desperados. A wide spot in the road, Woody Guthrie Center. There ain't no fancy doctors here to bind the cowboy's hurt. We just wash it at the water hole, then we dry it on his shirt. Woody Guthrie's Cowboys philosophy showcases how the songwriter remembered his Oklahoma and Western roots. 10 years ago, the Woody Guthrie Center opened in Tulsa, about an hour's way northeast of his birthplace in Okemah. It's dedicated to preserving Guthrie's legacy and vision. In addition to exhibits, the Tulsa Museum houses a growing archives and special collections with more than 10,000 items. The Guthrie Center is located next door to the Bob Dylan Center, which houses exhibits and archives of another iconic American songwriter who didn't ignore the West. The soundtrack for the 1973 movie Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and the song John Wesley Harding, even though Dylan misspelled the gunman's last name. Good Eats and Sleeps. Good Grub, Bricktown Brewery, Fort Smith, Arkansas. The Branch, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Back in Time Diner, Muskogee, Oklahoma. Simone's Cafe, Guthrie, Oklahoma. Good Lodging. Beeland Manor Inn Bed and Breakfast, Fort Smith, Arkansas. The Lodge at Sequoia State Park in Hulbert, Oklahoma. Stony Creek Hotel, Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. Pollard Bed and Breakfast, Guthrie, Oklahoma. True West Magazine, July-August 2023 edition. The 1873 Trapdoor Springfield, One Model, Many Changes, by Phil Spangenberger. Despite the prominence of repeating rifles of the late 19th century, the U.S. cavalry largely relied on this single-shot carbine to bring an end to the Indian Wars. The U.S. Army of the 19th century West faced challenges that made frontier warfare unique. Vast open plains, seemingly never-ending deserts, and rugged mountains terrain made movement slow and resupply difficult. The Army chased an elusive enemy that was fighting for their homeland by waging guerrilla warfare. Because a mobile mounted force was required to keep after the fast-moving, phantom-like Indians, much of the work fell to the cavalry, whose primary weapon was the 1873 Springfield Trapdoor Carbine. Created in 1873 for the new 4570 government round, the single-shot Springfield was produced by the Springfield Armory in Springfield, Massachusetts. Basically the same in appearance and action, the carbine and longer rifle were constantly going through subtle changes. A review of just the carbine variations here would require too much space. Suffice it to say that despite the 1886 experimental carbine and the officers' model rifles, the 1873, 1877, 1879, and 1884 carbines, official government model designations, were the primary issue arm of the U.S. cavalry during the campaigns against the American Indian tribes. The Sidehammer Springfield 4570 carbine weighed a light 7 pounds and was 41.3 inches in length with a 22-inch round barrel. The rifle fired a powerful 45x70 government cartridge using a 405 grain lead bullet and 70 grains of musket-grade black powder. The cavalry carbine usually used a lighter 55-grain powder charge because horse soldiers tended to be small of stature, usually weighing around 130 to 150 pounds, and the stiff recoil from the heavier rifle load too often proved detrimental to the trooper's accuracy. The 45x70 proved to be a more accurate and powerful load for longer range shooting than the previous 50-70 round. After the disastrous Little Bighorn fight in 1876, the carbine was much maligned. However, history has shown that tactics notwithstanding, what was then considered the fault of the weapon itself was actually more of a problem with the brittle copper cartridges, despite some other less critical weaknesses in the initial 1873 Springfield's design. In 1877, a transitional model upgraded from the first 1870 Springfield produced the most visible improvements over the original carbine. Changes included lengthening the comb of the stock and shortening and thickening the stock's wrist, while also stiffening the breech block by filling in the high arch of the earlier arm. Other significant changes consisted of an improved rear sight and drilling the buttstock with the three-hole receptacle for the three-piece jointed steel ramrod and headless shell extractor. A swiveling cover on the butt plate over the drilled holes was also added, thus the modern trap door moniker. A three-notch carbine safety notch tumbler lock mechanism, the three-click hammer, was added, and the 1873 date was omitted from the lock plate. The 1879 modifications included an improved rear sight, employing a buckhorn eyepiece attached to the slide, which can be moved laterally for wind, drift, or any construction errors in the carbine and rifle. The stacking swivel on the carbine's barrel band was also eliminated. The 1884 model differs from earlier carbines mostly with the addition of the model 1884 Buffington rear sight and the change of the breech block stamping to U.S. model 1884. By 1886, the firing pin was changed from steel to an aluminum bronze alloy, and in 1890, a rear sight protector barrel band and a front sight cover were added. Manufacturing of this model ceased in 1889. With nearly 61,000 carbines produced in the hands of regular Army troopers, the 1873 Springfield carbine, regardless of which variation, played a critical part in the frontier. During much of the Indian Wars, it was largely this carbine in the hands of troopers throughout the West who fought countless battles, rode endless patrols, and did scouting duty. Ironically, after vanquishing the American Indians to reservations, the Army worked to protect them from unscrupulous settlers. There's no doubt that the 1879 Springfield carbine belongs in that vaunted listing of guns that truly won the West. 4570 Springfield Collector's Book. Long considered the last word by serious students of the 4570 Trapdoor Springfields, the book, for collectors only, the 4570 Springfield, $34.95, by respected arms historians Joe Poyer and Craig Reich, is in reprint. Like the other works in their For Collectors Only series, this 315-page, 5.5-inch by 8.5-inch soft cover volume contains a part-by-part analysis of the various models, including serial number ranges, markings, finishes, and other details. Trapdoor fans will find this book an indispensable aid in identifying the vintage of any 4570 Trapdoor Springfield rifle, carbine, officers, and experimental models. Even fencing muskets, no matter how subtle, any changes of component parts are found. Also covered in this edition are tools, cartridge boxes, and prairie belts, ammunition, bayonets, and more, all shown through clear, detailed photos of parts and related gear. This writer has used the work numerous times and has found it to be invaluable in researching these historic weapons. True West Magazine, July-August 2023 edition. Will This Bell Toll Again? By Jana Bommersbach. Tombstone's First Episcopal Church says yes. On January 21, 1882, a 24-year-old divinity student wrote in his diary, "So begins my journey west. God grant that I may do some good." The good Endicott Peabody did in the forlorn place he was sent, a rough and rowdy mining town that had just witnessed a devastating gun battle near its OK Corral, was to build St. Paul's Church, giving Tombstone and Arizona Territory its first Episcopal Church. The church is still serving its congregation to this day, the oldest continuously operating Protestant church in Arizona. These days, its vicar is a former insurance claims adjuster from South Dakota who moved to Tombstone in 2016 with her husband. She was then drafted by the bishop and ordained in July of 2020, exactly 148 years after the doors opened. The Reverend Heather Rose shares a lot with the man who raised money here and there to build this small, cozy church. He needed $5,000 to construct the 25 by 70 foot Gothic Revival building on 3rd Street. He had a handful of parishioners when he got to Tombstone. But 6 months later when he left, he had not only built a new church, but a healthy roster of regular members. Reverend Rose has some of the same issues. There were only 5 parishioners when she got to town, but today she can count about 40. And she's been really busy raising money, too. She's raised almost half of the $60,000 she needs to restore the bell tower added to the church in 1866. People heard about it and just started donating, she said with pride. Perhaps that's because the Reverend Rose is a special kind of vicar. She's quickly endeared herself to the community. She was in Tombstone's annual Desert Donkey Dash with 80 contestants. Reverend Rose practiced for 7 days with a donkey named Levi, borrowed from the Good Enough Mine, and posted her practices on St. Paul's Facebook page. It got quite a following. She and Levi came in 53rd, and then she used Levi to deliver palms to the church on Palm Sunday. "We went down to the middle of Allen Street with the palms," she reports, the "we" being 20 to 30 parishioners. The church's founder is remembered as being engaged in the community, too. Peabody started a baseball league, and his revealing diary shows he dined often with would-be parishioners. Tombstone never forgot this man, who went on to be White House chaplain under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. St. Paul's wasn't Tombstone's first church. That honor goes to Sacred Heart Catholic Church, built in 1881, largely with the help of the angel of the mining camps, Nellie Cashman. Peabody's diary shows he ate at her restaurant one night in 1882. He pronounced it a fair dinner. Jana Bomersback has earned recognition as Arizona's Journalist of the Year and won an Emmy and two Lifetime Achievement Awards. She co-wrote the Emmy-winning Outrageous Arizona and has written three true crime books, a children's book, and the historical novel Cattle Kate. Her most recent book, co-written with Bob Bozbell, is Hellraisers and Trailblazers, The Real Women of the Wild West. True West, July-August 2023 edition. Cheyenne, Wyoming, by Peter Corbett. A hell-on-wheels town with a rowdy rodeo welcomes visitors to stay and enjoy the hometown atmosphere. It's America's smallest state by population, but boasts of having the world's largest outdoor rodeo and Western celebration. We're talking about Wyoming, the cowboy state, and its rambunctious rodeo celebration for Cheyenne Frontier Days, celebrated since 1897. This year, the Daddy of Them All rodeo festivities are July 21st through the 30th. Close to 250,000 people attend Frontier Days, which is equal to about 43% of Wyoming's population of 581,000. Cheyenne, Wyoming's capital and largest city, welcomes rodeo visitors with concerts, a carnival midway, Western art show, parades, and a pancake breakfast for 10,000 people. If that's not enough, Cheyenne also stages its Hell on Wheels rodeo combined with chuck wagon dinners. It's held at Laramie County Fairgrounds on six dates from June to early September. Hell on Wheels fits right in with Cheyenne's frontier history as a railroad town with a colorful past. "We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the Union Pacific," said Andy Jasperson, author of 100 Things to Do in Cheyenne Before You Die. General Grenville Dodge, Union Pacific Railroad chief engineer, and a survey crew plotted Cheyenne in 1867, where the tracks crossed Crow Creek. The Union Pacific's first work train steamed into Cheyenne on November 13, 1867. The site of the new town was roughly halfway between Omaha, Nebraska, and Ogden, Utah, near where the Union Pacific joined the Central Pacific Railroad at Promontory, Utah, in May 1869 to complete the Transcontinental Railroad. Cheyenne became an instant metropolis within months and was dubbed Magic City of the Plains. The Los Angeles Daily News reported that even before the Iron Horse arrived, thousands of spectators, traders, gamblers, and even prostitutes made their way to the railroad camp to get rich quick. The arcade with 50 gambling tables, four bars, and several bands was packed with a crowd eagerly waltzing to the tune of cards, greenbacks, and whiskey straight, according to the L.A. paper. By December 1868, the Union Pacific extended the tracks to Evanston in what became Wyoming's western edge upon statehood in 1890. A far less rowdy Cheyenne grew up to be the hub of transportation and commerce. The Union Pacific completed its majestic Cheyenne Depot in 1887. Built of large sandstone blocks, the depot with its six-story clock tower is bookend for downtown Cheyenne. 10 blocks away is the Wyoming State Capitol. Cheyenne actually has the last remaining Grand Depot on the Transcontinental Railroad, Jesperson said. "We're really spoiled." The Depot Museum spotlights Cheyenne and Union Pacific history. From a second-floor mezzanine, visitors watch trains pass with views of the railroad's roundhouse and steam shop. Depot Plaza hosts community festivals, Friday night summer concerts, and the Wyoming Brewers Festival, June 16th and 17th. Across the plaza is the Wrangler, an historic Western wear store that's operated by Boot Barn. The three-story building is vintage 1892, and it's been the Wrangler for 82 years. Shapers use steam to customize hats. "They find out how deep you want your creases and how high you want it to flip," Jesperson said. Visitors can take self-guided walking tours of Cheyenne of varying lengths or jump on the Cheyenne Street Railway trolley for a 90-minute Wild West history tour. One of Jesperson's favorite destinations is Terry Bison Ranch Resort, south of town. "It's a working bison ranch with a domesticated herd," she said. Visitors ride a train out into a pasture where they can feed the bison from a safe perch from the open coaches. You definitely couldn't do this in Yellowstone. She notes that a bison's tongue is sandpiper rough, like a giant cat's tongue. Another Cheyenne favorite is the Blue Raven Brewery in the historic Corson House. That is definitely a downtown favorite to hang out at on nice days because it's nice and shady on the patio, Jesperson said. I love that place. Where history meets the highway. First stop, visit Cheyenne, 1 Depot Square, West 15th Street, Cheyenne.org. Dress Western. Get your boots and hat at the Wrangler, a shop that's been selling Western wear for 80 years, bootbarn.com. Hamburger Delight. Two doors down, 118 East 17th Street, serves up more than a dozen gourmet burgers with bottomless French fries. The number 2doorsdown.net. Stay in an historic mansion. Nagel Warren Mansion Bed and Breakfast was built in 1888 by an early Cheyenne merchant and later occupied by one of Wyoming's first U.S. senators. NagelWarrenMansion.com. Raven About Vintage Microbrewery. Blue Raven Brewery serves its suds in the Corson House, an 1883 Queen Anne cottage. Beer is brewed in the carriage house. BlueRavenBrewery.com.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.